members. We have several bills to go through this afternoon on a beautiful Friday. And we're going to start off with a public hearing on House Bill 2585. Mr. Olson, if you would, please. Oh, actually, before we begin, Mr. Olson, I've started the work session. I want to welcome the youth advisory team that's here. Where are those guys? Hey, it's good to see you. That's Superintendent Susan Castillo's youth advisory team. They're here visiting the House Education Committee this afternoon. And this team's comprised of high school students from throughout the state who meet five times each year to discuss education issues and present recommendations to the state superintendent. Great to have you here. Thanks for putting in your time and energy to our education system, and don't be strangers to the House Committee on Education. You're always welcome here. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Mr. Chair, just generically, the questions were tough, but very politically and astutely presented.
Good. Thank you for your report, Representative. With that, if Mr. Olson will inform us on House Bill 2585.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2585 originally was drafted to create a task force on school counseling. However, there's a dash one amendment in front of the committee underneath the agenda that replaces the entire text of House Bill 2585 and amends Oregon Revised Statute 238.082 to allow an education service district to hire a retired public employee as a teacher or an administrator if the individual is, quote, employed by an education service district with primary work duties performed in a county with a population of not more than 35,000 inhabitants, unquote, rather than the current language, which only allows such a hire if the ESD, quote, has its administrative office, unquote, in such a county. This would take effect on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Jensen, thanks for coming forward with this proposal. Thanks for being here today. If you'd like to introduce it a little bit, we'd welcome that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I would like to express a special appreciation. But before I do that, let me back up here and get the protocol correctly and identify myself as State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58, which consists of most of Umatilla County, and a very tiny bit of Union County, that through the best of my efforts, I have yet to find a constituent in that part of the county. There's an awful lot of the best elk hunting in eastern Oregon there, but absolutely, as far as I can tell, except during elk season, no constituents there. I would like to express my deep appreciation and gratitude for the chair of the committee in hearing this bill, and especially in offering to put this in one of the bills that he had brought forward. It is truly fortunate for me that the chair was so kind and considerate with that. And I don't intend to try to explain this to you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, since there are people here from my district, from the ESD in my district, that are much better capable of doing that than I am. And I'd like to introduce to the committee Al Meunier, who is the interim superintendent of the Umatilla Mile County ESD, if you're ready for him as a...
Please, Al, you wonderful. Please join us. Thank you. Maybe just introduce yourself and let us know your thoughts on this proposal. We'd appreciate it.
You're not going to give you the rest of it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. That's it. You can just give this over to the committee administrator.
My name is Al Meunier, and as Chuck has already alluded to, I am the interim superintendent of Umatilla Mile ESD, which covers a good section of eastern Oregon. And I have brought with me Deb Oliver, who is our regional program director for special education. And the material that I'm handing out sort of explains the issue that we're facing today in terms of of our request for a change in the legislation. The state of Oregon is divided up into 8 regions for certain special ed specialties that deal with high-cost, low-incidence children, and they are listed on the front of the material that we've handed out. If you open it to the second page, there's a map, and as you can see, Umatilla County covers virtually all of eastern Oregon. And what has happened is that in some of our rural areas, it's impossible to get people to serve those children who are the most severely handicapped children that we serve. And specialists are very hard to come by, even in cities of significant population, and virtually impossible in that rural region. So if you turn to the third page, the proposed amendment is very important to the children with disabilities who live in rural Oregon. Umatilla Model ESD is a contractor for regional special education programs in eastern Oregon. We serve all of the counties in the eastern portion of the state. All of the specialists in physical therapy, speech pathology, occupational therapy, and services for the visually impaired are employees of Umatilla Model Education Service District, which is located in Pendleton. Umatilla is the only county in eastern Oregon which has a population in excess of 35,000. If you're retired under the rules governing the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System, your employer is located in a county that exceeds 35,000 in population, you can only work 1,040 hours per calendar year. This means that UMESD cannot hire retired personnel even if their primary workstation is in a county with population less than the required 35,000. Many of the specialists required to serve the special education students in eastern Oregon are very difficult to employ because of a national scarcity of trained people. This amendment will allow UMESD to employ retirees if the primary workstation is located in a county of less than 35,000 people. The change would also assist a limited number of other education service districts. And I'm going to turn to Deb, who is much more familiar with the specifics of this region in terms of special education, to kind of walk you through the last page.
Thank you. If you refer to the map, the 8 regional heads...
Lisa, could you please identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Deb Oliver, and I'm from Umatilla Model ESD.
Thank you.
Director of Regional Programs.
Thank you.
Okay. The 8 regional heads are all located in ESDs, and if you look at the map, we have the black dots, which shows where the regional heads are. In addition to regional programs, there's early intervention programs, long-term care and treatment programs, and corrections programs, all located and administered out of these ESDs. None of them can currently take advantage of this bill, even though all of those areas are highly specialized and need highly trained people. 57% of all that we do goes directly back to our districts within those counties. And so with districts facing the highly qualified issues, we like to work cooperatively with them. I pulled the 8 regional directors. All of them are in favor of this. As you look at the map, if it has a check within the region, those are the under 35,000 counties within each region. So as you can see, the yellow and the blue regions serve 14 counties, and the only two counties that are above the 35,000 are Deschutes and Umatilla, which are the administrative heads of both of those. However, the geographic area is about half of Oregon. This bill would allow us some flexibility and allow our retirees to hire back. We also gathered information of the 8 regional programs. Within the next 5 years, 20 to 40% of these specialists will reach retirement age. An example would be if you look at our region, I am based in Union County with an office of about 20 people that are all specialists, occupational therapists, speech pathologists, autism specialists. That's the closest one to Umatilla County, but we still could not hire those people that are based there back. We also have people based in Baker County, Grant County, and Malheur County. Malheur County, our people based in Malheur County are 200 miles from the administrative unit and are, again, in counties less than 35,000. So we want to urge you to consider this for the services to children with disabilities and unique needs in our rural areas.
Thank you. Any questions, members?
Sure. Mr. Donald. This question is for you. Do we have a model upon which this is based? Are we doing this anywhere else?
You know, I'm not sure other states have the same limitation on PERS retirements, and some could, in fact, be more stringent. But the short answer is no, John. We do know that the specialists who retire, we have hired retired people from other states that have worked out very well for us. And what it does, it just increases the pool that we have to select from. It's obvious that in some cases we have no pool. And I think this would alleviate some of the stress that we have on the programs for children that really do need help.
We do have a somewhat similar model in that counties with a population of less than 35,000 can hire teachers. And that law was designed, I believe, 4 or 5 sessions ago. And it literally saved some of our rural schools. It is hard when you live in the metropolitan area to imagine attracting a social studies teacher, and I hesitate to name one of our districts, but unless you're born and raised there, there's a lot to go there for. And I know with occupational therapy and speech therapy, it's almost impossible. And I think that we could help rural Oregon immensely if we would allow them to bring back people that live in that country. And this is a rural, sparsely populated county bill.
What you say is correct, John. We are able to. If you are a resident and are hired by a school district in counties under 35,000 population, you can continue to work. The change that this makes is for a very insignificant number of people.
Where does that come?
Thank you, Chair Buckley. This is for Ms. Oliver. We've had several really incredible presentations about the early intervention programs in Oregon. Does this map in the discernment of regions, does that mirror what the regions are for early intervention? Is it close?
It's very close. There are 8 regions for regional programs, and there are 10 for early intervention, and they are very, very close. Many of them are the same. For our agency, we are the contractor for early intervention also, mm-hmm. and it's the same 7 counties. So the blue and the yellow are identical.
Well, thank you. Just a follow-up comment. There are people that are working very hard in many areas of government and schools to have an aligned system, K-20, and some of us feel that that alignment would start best with the early intervention because the regions are already so well-defined, and they've done just an outstanding job of laying the foundation for children. So appreciate your work. And also, just to let members know that the problem with the shortage of speech pathologists, we have Chemeca Community College is going to be bringing forth a bill next week to hopefully start funding a program and getting some speech pathology going.
3141, and we would like to support that all.
So noted. Any additional questions? If not, I'm going to thank you for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2581. And do I have the right number there? 2585, sorry. And open up the work session on House Bill 2585. And we have an amendment here before us. Representative Dahl.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2585.
Representative Dahlem has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 2585. Is there discussion? Hearing none. Is there objection? Hearing none, so amended. Representative Dahlem.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2585 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended, thank you.
Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 2585 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion?
There, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
There is no subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this. I mean, I don't see one mentioned anywhere. I just want to make sure that there isn't.
I don't think there's a rule to it. This would simply affect local ESD hiring. No impact.
We don't have that.
Just want to I do have a question. I apologize for not asking this sooner, but is there an effect as far as the PERS system is concerned, or when these people are hired back, are they hired back as not paying any more into the system? So, and then the second question that goes along with that is, that are they continuing to receive their PERS benefits while they're also receiving the salary from the ESD?
Do you respond to that question?
They would not continue to pay into the system, but they would receive their PERS benefit.
They would,
yes.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may, this is the very double dipping that that we have people in the metro area complaining about when we have a person, for example, that retires as a firefighter. Or a teacher and then becomes a member of, say, a county commission or the legislature, and they're getting both their PERS benefit and an additional salary from somebody else.
The fact of the matter is, this is a political issue, even in rural Oregon. Should a person be able to draw their retirement while they teach? And it's a heated issue. But I, as a superintendent, would stand the heat when I didn't have anybody. Again, it's hard to convey the feeling. There's great competition for a job in the metropolitan area. Finding candidates for speech therapy in the counties that have check marks on them, I believe the superintendent and the special ed director would suffer that abuse because the candidates are so hard to find, and the children are in no less need of the services. So, Representative Crummell, your point is well taken and is absolutely correct, and I have suffered the slings and arrows of hiring a principal. Under these circumstances, his salary was horrendous, but he lived in a little tiny town and stayed there, and I don't have to look anymore. So you are correct that the bill does what the bill is designed to do. It staffs difficult to staff positions.
My only concern, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate the fact that, you know, in places like John Day and
please don't mention my places,
other Ontario and places like that, but it's actually, you know, when a organization is recruiting somebody, you have to recruit the spouse as much as you have to recruit the actual candidate, because if the spouse isn't doesn't want to go there, then it makes it really difficult. What I wish we could do is make it explicit that either they're not receiving their PERS benefit at the same time that they're being paid this big salary, so that there's not a double dipping, or that they're and I don't know how we fix it, but I'm just concerned about that issue, because you have a person that, you know, if they were a retired principal, was making, what, $80,000 a year maybe, and then on PERS are making, $40,000 a year, and now with going back as a principal, so now they're making $120,000 a year, but they're... quote-unquote retired. And the frame doesn't necessarily make the distinction.
You have framed the issue exactly correctly. And I'm not sure, in my time as a superintendent, I always used incentives. I didn't get a lot of support for that, but I thought that if you can incent somebody to do something, and that's what this is. The lure of the city is great, and when one retires, and you've done all the hunting, and all the fishing, and all the pinochle, and all the school carnivals that you can, it's off to the city you go. That's what you do in my part of the state. Hunt and fish and visit with your neighbors. But when you retire, you usually leave if you have the wherewithal to do it. So I understand your concern. I share your concern, but I don't know how else to get a speech therapist. I remember, to give you I had a speech therapist from Alabama call one time. At that time, I was serving as a superintendent in Montana, and I asked her if she would come, and she said, "What's the weather like?" I said, "I think it's 20 below," and she hung up. And that's the only one I can even get to talk to me. So I don't think it's hard to explain the difficulty in filling positions in particular. Let's look at the speech therapist and look at the size of that region. We used to jokingly say we'll get them a car, a coffee comforter, and call when you get where their work is. There's huge distances between kids that need the service. In the ESD that I was in, I'd venture to say a speech therapist would spend a third of their time on the road, or maybe more.
Yes, and Representative Don, one thing that I haven't said is already in all of those counties there are people who are retired who are still working, because PERS rules allow them to do that.
Satisfy me on one thing, please, and that is that before a superintendent goes to hiring or hiring back a retiree, that they've exhausted their sources for candidates, and that there really are none. But as you said, the children still need the services, and I'm not denying that. But satisfy me with that. That's one of the things that's happened.
I won't speak for Al, but I'll speak for myself. When you're in a small rural community, and you don't take an opportunity to bring in some new blood, a new family, and usually when you go looking for people, you look for people that have kids, and if you don't exercise that opportunity, you get some splaining to do. I'm going to focus on the rural area. The unemployment rate in Sherman County would go down a full 15% if we put one more person to work. Let's look at the scope of the problem. When you have an opportunity to get new people, I think you have to put two things together. The district's desire for new people, but you also have to put together the scarcity of the disciplines that these people are searching for. I can speak for one tiny district. You always wanted new blood.
Following up on Representative Crowell's question, is there any requirement to post a job opening rather than simply fill it with a retired employee?
At Umatilla tomorrow, we would certainly post all openings. Deb has been there a lot longer than I have, so I should probably let her speak.
One example is that we have had a vision opening posted for 3 years. We've had an orientation mobility posted for 3 years. We just got our first applicant for the vision program in the last few months. We are between 2 and 3 speech pathologist jobs not filled every year. And that actually is a state problem, but it's more of a problem for us. So if you went on the website, you would almost forever see those jobs advertised in our area.
Mr.
Mr. Chair.
I just wanted to comment that Representative Down has persuaded me, and I'm ready to vote when you are.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Down is awfully convincing.
He is.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Clinton? Aye.
Representative
Dolan? Aye.
Representative Greenlight?
Excused.
Representative Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Excused.
Representative Wiedner?
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. Motion carries. And we'll ask Representative Jensen if he would like to be the carrier on this bill. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 2585. Thank you very much for being here, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I hope you can fill those positions quickly. We were going to open up a work session on House Bill... let's start with 3338. We have the benefit of having Mr. Sager here from the Governor's Office. For those of you who are not on the Subcommittee of Education Innovation, this will be an introduction of this bill to you. And after we complete this one, I also want to ask Mr. Sager to explain House Bill 2214 to the committee as well. I don't intend to move on either of these bills today. I want to make sure they're fully understood by the committee. We have time, with the time we have left, to fully go into these bills before we move on. But I do appreciate you being here, Mr. Sager. And after Mr. Olson describes House Bill 3338, I'd appreciate your thoughts on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3338, which was heard in the Subcommittee on Education Innovation yesterday, creates an education system design team, which specifies the membership and duties of the design team, appropriates money from the general fund to the Office of the Governor for the design team, and sunsets the design team on the date of convening the next regular biennial legislative session, declares an emergency, is effective July 1st. You have before you a dash 2 amendment. The staff measure summary says dash 1. It's now been replaced by the dash 2, which made a small technical fix on membership, explaining who is the membership. So I will speak to the dash 2, but again, it's virtually identical to the dash 1. The dash 2 amendment would replace the entire text of House Bill 3338, change the membership of and focus of the education design team to, quote, design a new legislative process for review and decision making regarding, unquote, the governor's unified 2009-2011 K-20 public education budget request. The new membership, the membership of the design team in the dash 2 amendment is 5 representatives, 5 senators. Not all can be of the same party. That's the clarification from the dash 1, and a representative from the governor's office. The amendment would direct the design team to, quote, work with the Quality Education Commission, post-secondary Quality Education Commission established by the governor, and with work groups created by the Joint Board of Education to, quote, design a legislative system to review a comprehensive pre-kindergarten through higher education budget and policy presentation, and in collaboration with the Office of the Governor and work groups created by the joint boards, recommend methods of financially supporting an education system with the 40-40-20 goals, which I'm sure Mr. Sager will explain. And this bill has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Sager, since we had you warm up yesterday, I'm sure you're ready to roll, so take it over.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, James Sager, Governor's Office, and I apologize that I didn't bring additional copies of my wonderful little chart that I handed to the committee members yesterday. Let me.
Well, I'm sorry, I can't put it up to Mr. Chair. We might have moved on.
I apologize. The Representative Comp and other members of the legislature worked during the interim on looking at the education enterprise and how we coordinate the policy work, budgeting work, and legislative work together. The reason for the change in House Bill 3338 to the now-2 amendment is that, as I showed in the chart yesterday, and I hope you're sharing with each other, Over the past few years, in fact, within the education enterprise, we have done a great deal of work at the direction of the governor in having the joint boards of education, the different education committees and work groups work together on aligning the policies and the budget work of the system. And in fact, we were looking forward to and hoping that we could begin this legislative session actually coming to the legislature and presenting to you the overall picture of how the budget was driving the policy decisions and how those choices were in fact aligned and connected. What was discovered was the fact that while we were ready and many of you wish to have that to receive that report, there isn't a process by which in the legislative system we can bring that forward, and that the committee structure and the Ways and Means structure is designed to do that. So what the Dash 2 amendment does is say that in the interim, the legislature, working with the governor's office, needs to look at how we would suggest changes be inside the legislative structure, and then working with all the partners, be able to make sure that that when the report comes forward, we're actually able to present material in such a manner that it answers the kinds of questions that you want as policymakers in order to help us make decisions long term. The governor has been trying to get all of us to think beyond the two-year window that we normally do within the legislative process and look at policy and budgeting over a long-term period. And again, you have to be able to have conversations about what that looks like, what the component parts are, and be able to present the material so that you understand why it's important to invest in a certain element of the education continuum over something else. So how you're building to prepare for the next biennium so that, in fact, the education enterprise can continue to move forward. So this is a proposal to have this work group look at that legislative design, work with the education community to make sure that we're in alignment for the 2009 session. Happy to answer any questions.
Representative Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission exist yet?
Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, that is a very good question, and timing is everything. Sometimes bills move before other actions can. The governor has been talking for some time about the need to have the same kind of clarity for community college and universities as we have for K-12. And so, in fact, that is work in progress, and it will be coming forward very shortly.
Let's follow up. Is that, I don't know how the QEC actually is that a legislative thing as well, or just sort of executive activity?
The original Quality Ed Commission was established by executive order. That's the process we're following, looking at the post-secondary system, and then later the legislature said, gee, we like this, and so we put it into statute. And so again, if the kind of beginning work is successful, which we hope it will be, that probably will be hopefully the step that the legislature takes.
If we do know yet what that might look like, I just wondered if we think we'll have, I mean, I assume, but just so I ask, community colleges, Oregon University System, will we have students from community colleges and Oregon University System as well as people, or I don't know what the vision is exactly, but in that context, you know, when I vote for something, as you know, and I don't know what it is, I'm kind of curious who's on it. And so I would like to see students involved. Of course, I'd like to see OSLAC involved in everything, but I don't know if that actually fits this thing or not. So.
Representative Clem, your interests are duly noted, and I'm sure we will be able to address those all to your satisfaction.
All right.
Sorry. Thank you, Representative. Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. And it's a comment more than anything. This is my second session. In last session, I found that frequently we haven't built good bridges between the legislature and the Department of Education. And now this session, I've increased my learning. I feel like there's been many, many, many times that we are not aware as a legislature of other great work that's being done in other governing bodies, such as the governor's office. And this work that all of us have started in different stages and places has needed a home. And so I would hope that however this works out, we just remember that everybody is working for the same outcome for students and our society, but somehow we got to get us all together in the same room, and I hope this bill helps do that.
Thank you. President Kremel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In reading through this, I see that in Section 3, it out of the general fund and appropriated to the Office of the Governor is $1 million for the purposes of the education design system or system design team. I happen to be on the General Government Ways and Means Committee that is reviewing right now, as almost as we speak, the governor's budget. Is this $1 million already accounted for in that $13 million budget?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummel, no, it is not, in part because this was not the governor's bill. This is a bill that the governor's office has become involved with because we've been helping to work with Representative Comp in bringing this together.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair.
Please follow.
Well, are you going to give us that $1 million?
What I would be saying is that within the budget that's already been presented to Ways and Means, that $1 million would have to be in there.
We welcome the opportunity to present to Ways and Means.
Because the governor's office is already asking for a 30%+ increase in their budget.
Okay, I think that's the question.
So we'll have to have that discussion another day. On the second page, under C, and then starting with capital A, on line 7, these are the Oregon benchmarks, correct? All students graduate from high school. 40% graduates earn an associate or equivalent. 40% go to earn a bachelor's degree. Ensure that Oregon world class education is due to the majority of them. Stopping at line 12. Isn't that part of the Oregon benchmark?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummel, no. Those are the goals that have been agreed to by the Joint Boards of Education. Again, the governor had asked us to look out to 2025 and ask the question, where do we want and need to be as a state to be competitive in the world economy? And I think as we've had some conversations in other committees, maybe that is overly ambitious, but at the same time, the governor wanted us to make sure that we put a stake in the ground out there that is a target that we should aspire to. And so these are agreed to by the Joint Boards of Education.
Okay. And then my other question is more to staff, Mr. Chair. This bill came to us from the Innovation Sub. Mm-hmm. Was it sent to us with a recommendation? Was it sent to us with the amendment already attached?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, yes, the Dash 1 amendment was adopted unanimously, and it was sent to do pass as amended recommendation to the full unanimously. We would have to re-adopt an amendment in the full anyway, so we can adopt the Dash 2 instead of the Dash 1. If we were to choose to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With a due pass recommendation.
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummel, the recommendation from the sub was due pass as amended.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, just as a point of privilege, mm-hmm. if I may, it would be real helpful, I think, to us is that when Mr. Olson does the SMS, when a bill is coming to us from a sub, to include in that what the recommendation from the committee is. I think that would be very helpful to all of us, and we wouldn't have to be asking that, and it would help us then in the future as well. So I make that request.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is that all?
Yes, I want to make a point of clarification. When Representative Crummel asked, this came to us from the Committee on Innovation, which some of you comp chaired. It certainly did. But behind that Committee on Innovation and behind Chair Comp's promulgating the idea is the Chalkboard Project, the Oregon Business Council, several other councils that I'm aware of. The Governor's Office is now involved. And I would not want to diminish one bit Chair Comps promulgating and disseminating that notion, but this is an idea whose time is long past. We can no longer address education in its parts. We must address it in its whole. I think I can even speak for the Workforce and Economic Development Committee in this House. We're wondering if we shouldn't meet with you because this is so important. So I felt compelled to make that clarification for Representative Crummell. Lots of people, Republican, Democrat, legislative, executive, all stakeholders have been involved over a long process.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions? Mr. Chair, Representative Lynn.
And thus, in this work group, I understand just the five members of the Senate and five members of the House and also Governor's Office. Is there anyone representing from the Department of Education?
Chair Buckley, Representative, not in this piece, because again, this is focused on looking at the legislative process. But as we call out in the bill, this work group is to work closely with the education stakeholders, which is broader than just the Department of Education, community colleges, universities, the entire system, to make sure that the process is designed then to accept that total presentation, that the presentation matches up to what all of you need at that point in time.
Okay. Follow-up question. Did I hear this is going to cost about $1 million?
Correct, Representative. That's in Section 3 of the bill on page
Section 3. Yeah. Okay. And then a follow-up question. Usually when I see some study group, I never see it costing, you know, $1 million. Yes. It's $50,000, $100,000, maybe maximum $200,000. It seems to $1 million very excess, more than I can imagine.
That was my question yesterday, Representative.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
We should allow Mr. Sager and Representative Kopp to respond, I think. That's a good question.
I missed that part.
Chair Buckley, Representative I appreciate the question, and that was the dollar amount in the original bill, and so when we rewrote the bill to have the focus, we just didn't deal with that, and I'm sure that is an issue that will be dealt with in Ways and Means, and we can discuss what the, you know, if there's a fine-tuning that needs to be done as to the breadth of the work. The information that was presented to Representative Comp, and I definitely don't want to speak for her, but the argument was made that to be able to potentially hire the kinds of facilitators and experts that would be able to help us in this process, because this is something that really puts Oregon on the cutting edge. There's no other state that we can find that is trying to develop this kind of coordinated effort, that in fact hiring those outside experts might cost us a little bit of money, and we were trying to come up with a number.
Okay. Just a small comment, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
It seems to me we're studying a lot. And study this, study that. And then it seems to me too many study. And I'm sure this will do good. But I'd like to see some kind of a good result out of it.
So none of it is on there.
Thanks, Chair Buckley. And Representative Lim, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, I just kind of went head on head with the speaker this week about another task force in another area. But what I would say to this bill, this is a continuation of a lot of work that has already been done, as Representative Dahlin pointed out so well, in that when we're talking about a $6 billion investment of our general fund, $1 million is, I believe it's a foothold or whatever we need to, and we do have a real short timeline on this. This is to be ready for the 2009 session. And so we might need somebody to help facilitate a meeting to get us to move forward instead of sitting and talking about politics all day. But that's the intent, and as it goes to Ways and Means, I believe they will take good action with it.
Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Representative. And just to clarify, too, the, on page 2 of the bill, line 28, it does require a report to the interim legislative committees on or before February 1st, 2008. So Representative Kampf is quite correct that this is intended to move quickly and get answers provided quickly. Are there further questions or comments or clarifications? Representative Cromwell.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So I just want to make sure that I understand correctly. The work that this design team is going to do is to, and their purpose, their whole mission, is to design a new legislative process for review of and decision making regarding our education agency budgets, which is K-12 plus higher ed and community colleges, and to make the process holistic, to work with the Quality Education Commission and the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission that the governor is going to establish by executive order, most likely, and the joint boards, and then to sadly, a little redundant here, design a legislative system to review a comprehensive pre-K through higher ed policy presentation. And to do that in collaboration with the governor's office and the joint boards. And the outcome that we're expecting is a report to the 2009 legislative session, and we get it all for $1 million.
That's correct.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding, you know, what the goal of this organization is and what the outcome is. The outcome is a report that hopefully steers us in a direction that the legislature may or may not choose to go, but steers us in a direction to start talking about the education system as a complete system, as opposed to talking about education in its segments of K-12, community colleges, and higher ed, and all three of them competing for the same dollars.
Vice Chair Kampf, would like to respond.
I think you nailed it, with one exception, and that is on line 26 on page 2. That report will come at the next, when we meet in next February. And the next phrase is really important. It's, and may include recommendations, so that there is the capacity and the time, if the way we're set up for the next session is, then that action will be taken.
Okay, thank you. In a follow-up to that, if I may, Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
then, Representative, would it be, and I didn't see it in here specifically, so that's why I'm asking this question, would this design team have the authority to go to legislative council and ask for drafts, or would that be something that would be done by the interim committee on education or some other method? What I want to make sure of is that if they're going to make recommendations, that they have a vehicle for being able to make those recommendations. And I'm just, and I didn't see it specifically in here, so that's why I'm asking. I'm not trying to stump anybody or
no, but
or put anybody
did you have a
on,
comment about process, Chair Buckley?
I was just going to comment on page 3 of the bill, line 9. It does discuss all agencies of state government as defined in ORS 174111, and all school districts, etc., are directed to assist the design team. I would assume that means assistance would be providing the services required, but it's a legitimate question to bring up, Representative. Mr. Say, do you have any response?
Well, Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, because this group is going to be required to present a report to the special legislative session in February, the concept that we had in mind is at that point we're either going to get the green light to continue to move ahead, or in fact the legislature will say, thank you very much, no thank you. And then we have a period of time to actually fine-tune the presentation. So there are a number of vehicles that we could use to pre-session file, whether the legislature agrees to allow this group to pre-session file, or clearly through any of you or through the governor's office or some collaboration with you and the governor's office. So I'm not worried about the vehicles to get the ideas into the legislative process. It's really making sure that we have that touchstone along the way that we're heading in the right direction. Because as we see this in the end, you did nail it well when you described what was going on. I guess the one additional piece I would add to it is that this could revolutionize the way the legislature, all of you, operate when it comes to dealing with, in this case, the education enterprise budget, and maybe eventually even other areas of the budget if you see the value in this kind of approach, so that it really does help us focus on what are the state policies that policymakers need to be making to help us move, in this case, the education enterprise, all the students, towards the goals that we have as a state.
Mr. Chair, I have a feeling on the whole legislative concept that's actually kind of the point of this bill, is that we don't have a vehicle or a process right now in the legislature to even have this task force initiate a legislative concept. But I have a feeling one of the members on this thing would be happy to introduce the bills at the request of the design team. But we got to set all this up. That's kind of the point. In this building, we don't really have a way for a unified group like this to act as a group, because it's not a committee of the legislature. It's not a chair committee. It's its right. own thing. But someone will do it, I'm sure, and after that, we can, if it really is going to exist past 08, we can figure out how they can have their own process.
Well, with 5 senators and 5 representatives, I'm sure there'd be multiple.
Yeah, probably 10.
That's probably 10. 10 would be if you want to do so. Members, we were just about to make a motion. I just want to clarify, I did say that we weren't going to move on this when I started discussion today, and if members are not comfortable moving it, I'm glad to hold off and schedule this session. If you are comfortable, I'd be happy to send this to Ways and Means. I do have concern over the $1 million, and I do hope that Ways and Means would really focus down on what that cost. I mean, when we have other programs that are hurting so badly, that I do have a concern of this. I really recognize the importance of this work, but again, it is a concern in terms of expenditure. And Representative Greenock, I checked with you since he's in discussion with his assistant there. So,
I feel like a fifth grader that wants to answer the question. Call on me. I think Representative Crummell, over the interim, the small part that I played, we met, in fact, across the river one time. I had to report my trip to Washington State. It's convenient, but for me, it is so logical, because when the Oregon Business Council had their meeting in Portland, my part of the speech was transparent budget pre-K to 20, targeted budget pre-K to 20, and I have seen the vehicle in its very elementary stages that would do that. And if that could be provided to Representative Crummell, I think this might make more sense. The work isn't going to start from scratch. The work has been in progress. I think with the audits committee you served on, you will be able to see education top to bottom. If we're losing 91% of our graduates in the high school, then we know that we have to target money to retain those students. If we're getting them all out of high school and only 8% of them are going on to higher ed, we see that in the process. And so it allows us, when we make decisions about education, to look where the problems are. If our students enter school not ready to read, we know where to go. If they come out of the third grade not reading, we know where to go. And I feel that I am at such an advantage, having participated in that for 18 months. I would like to get Representative Crummell and anyone on this council that does not have the budget schematic, my term, so they can see how we need a legislative overview. I think it would put a lot of questions to rest. I cover that part where in ranching you look across the table at the banker and he knows he has to trust you. and nobody likes that part of the meeting. Trust me, Representative Crumbles.
Can he foreclose if you don't come through?
I don't want to talk about it.
Let me toss something out there, Mr. Chair, and just get a sense for how the rest of the committee would feel, if that's all right with you. Because sending this with any kind of a recommendation to the Ways and Means folks, I have a real problem with $1 million. I think a design team, you know, we ought to get one hell of a report. And they could probably meet every day because they could be full time at this. They wouldn't need to be, you know. But anyway, and I know that's not the intention. So, but the other thing that I'm wondering is that so that they do have a vehicle, irrespective of who sponsors it, whether it be a legislative committee or an individual legislator or a request from the governor, since the governor's office does have that authority, or a request from the superintendent because she has that authority also, that the words "at the request of the design team" have to appear on there. And the reason why I say that is because I think the next legislature should know when a recommendation or a request is truly coming from this group and not somebody who just sort of thought, you know, they discussed this at that design team thing, and I think it's a heck of an idea, so I'm going to go ahead and write a bill about that and just, you know, and just put it in there and see if it'll roll. I want to provide vehicles and a variety of vehicles for them to be able to make requests for legislation. I'm not trying to stop that, but I want the recognition to be that this is a product of the design team. Let me toss those out there. Are those requests that are like too heavy or?
Mr. Chairman,
where's the agreement?
Yeah, Representative Crumbles, I think the issue is, as a general issue, let's not talk about this bill in a moment, but some of the same things that we've been grappling with in our committee. It seems to me when you send it to Ways and Means with no recommendation, it's basically a soft no. It seems to me the committee job is to vet it substantively, and then it's Ways and Means to deal with how to fund it if they want to, and they're going to think of that by their own substantive issues as well. But it seems to me that we have an obligation. I mean, we have three options in this case: send it with a recommendation, send it with no recommendation, and simply saying no to it. And it seems to me that the last two are basically saying that we don't approve of it on substantive grounds, and you can do what you want, which in essence I think is bury it. I think if we substantively approve the idea, we think this is a good idea, we sort of have an obligation to, you know, to throw the chips into the game. And I think if we think the idea is a sensible idea from an educational perspective, we ought to send it with a recommendation. If we don't, then we ought to say, I'm willing to say no. I'm happy to say, let's bury the sucker. Which, I'm not saying either. I wasn't speaking about this substantively at all.
Thank you, Representative. Where's that going?
I just wanted to speak to this bill on that part. I would like to send it with a due pass recommendation, but I guess I need some guidance from more senior members. Can you just put a blank line in there? Is that the practical effect of when it gets there anyway? They're going to do whatever they want anyway. It depends how well you lobby it. I sent one bill down with a blank line, but I don't know if that was a dumb move or not. I'd be fine taking the dollar figure out, putting a blank line, then let Representative Cobb lobby this bill and the rest of the folks down Ways and Means if to get to a due pass. So I think the due pass is important. I agree with that.
What was that, Lynn?
Thank you. Since Representative Klein mentioned the senior member, I think I belong there.
Yes,
okay, so, and exactly the line you were thinking, I was the same line. And take the amount out, let what Ways and Means figure out. I think this is a good deal. I think we should send with the recommendation while deleting just the dollar amount.
Mr. Sager, did you have a comment?
If you allow me, please, Chair Buckley, to try to address Representative Krummel's issue, and as far as the dollar amount, again, we weren't advocating for a particular dollar amount. We're advocating for the work. But it seems important to point out that exactly the conversation that we're having here today is why we need this bill. Because in various committees now, I have made various presentations on different parts of all the work that has come forward to this point, including the alignment of the work, the yield model work that we're doing. All of that is outside the legislative process, but as legislators, there's no way for us to share that all with you in a format where you say, oh, I see, you're actually putting these pieces together. And so that's why, to address exactly the kinds of questions that you're asking short of the dollar amount, is exactly why this work is necessary.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make just two comments, and I understand where Representative Krummel and Representative Lim and yourself are thinking, you know, $1 million, and I'd be more than happy. We have people that were part of this 18-month group, and all of them have signed on to this bill, and if we all want to go lobby together to ways and means, so be it. But the only thing that I would share, and I shared this in committee yesterday, I know of two school districts in Oregon for sure, and when they did strategic planning, it was about 8 years ago or further back, they paid a consultant $350,000 to develop a strategic plan. When I hire an education consultant to teach bilingual education or how to teach differentiated education, it is not uncommon to pay $2,000 a day. These are people that have worldwide experience in these issues. They work with CEO companies that are the best in the world. And I think that's what our children deserve, but if we need to, I'm more than willing to go say this to Ways and Means and take the dollar figure out and leave a blank.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kopp. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krummel.
I think, you know, I mean, the free search and filing issue, I guess, isn't as big a deal. I would like to see that kind of language in there, though, so that the group is recognized for the work that they do. But I think if we could strike the $1 million and let Ways and Means figure out how much they think ought to be used for this. I mean, from the standpoint of the overall policy, I support that. I would probably even enthusiastically support it because I think there is a lot of consternation about it. But if we're going to send it with a DPAS recommendation with $1 million in there, I'm going to give a courtesy no vote here with the option of voting yes on the floor when it comes out of Ways and Means with an amount that's been received.
I think you meant that courtesy no.
Make sure you put no where that came from.
That's right. I think there was a really agreement that was given courtesy no votes.
So is there Krummel volunteering to help you with Ways and Means, Vice Chair Popoff? Given I heard that he'll be next to you there making the presentation.
Okay.
I think will be very helpful. And from talking to the community administrator here, it does seem that the prudent way would be actually asked for legislative council, even though we're striking two words from the bill, to actually do that through an amendment. Any counsel on that, Representative Greenleck?
Well, we were told by Ms. Kennedy that it would be all right to do something like that. Change one number out as a conceptual amendment. It's cleaner to do it by doing it. So we can do it, a cleaner version. And
Mr.
that's the time, you know, we have time.
I would suggest, Mr. Chair, since we do have time, that we, if the committee chooses to strike that, we ask for a -3, striking, putting in a blank line, and carry over the bill to the Tuesday committee, and then we can immediately issue an agenda before close of business today listing it.
Will Tuesday be a...
Tuesday is the full...
schedule as have disappeared permission. We are trying to not schedule for Thursday to try to give you some extra time if we can, Representative. So it seems that is the sense of the committee, if I'm reading the committee correctly. What we will do then is that we will ask Mr. Olson to make that -3 amendment happen for us. And Vice Chair Kopp, you comfortable?
Absolutely.
Then I will go ahead and I will close a work session on. Oh, do you want to adopt it? We're going to get another dash. We need the -3 anyway.
Move the -3 amendment.
Can we do that? -3 and save Tuesday's meeting.
This is highly recommended. We don't need legal advice.
Since Mr. Olson and I are
make laws here.
We're new to our positions. We will. All right.
We'll throw the line as long as we can, Representative Green. I don't want to downgrade the governor's office, but here's the chart that Mr. Sager, for all of you, missed.
But Representative Cremel did have a great comment about the chart.
I didn't know where it allowed you to do it in prison. That's great.
Thank you very much for your work on that, members. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 3338. We'll carry it over to Tuesday. Tuesday's session of the full Education Committee, and Mr. Olson will, I'm sure, have the -3s for us at that time. Senator Bates is due here any minute to.
Can I ask a question for Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would it make sense to strike that whole section? And then a fiscal will come in from the revenue. I mean, I'm not sure if you're not going to put an amount on, why we need that section at all. And section 3 in the
dashboard. So we open a work session on House Bill 3338 since we are in discussion of the bill.
I think in my experience, when you want an appropriation, you leave the language in for the appropriation, but you take out the amount, understanding that and maybe what you want to do is go in with the request a ways means for $1 million or $500,000 or $18 million or whatever. But and then understanding that Ways and Means is going to put an amount of money in there.
Yeah.
But I think the problem that putting the amount of money in there from this committee creates is that Ways and Means looks at it and says $1 million. I don't know about that. And then they,
I wasn't arguing for the amount. I was simply arguing that if we didn't have an amount in there, I wasn't sure we need all of Section 3.
Right.
Because it would be clear that whatever appropriation will go to the governor's office to manage it. But I don't think it's a big point. It's just a little redundancy.
Right. Very good. Thank you, Representative.
The LC can think about it.
Any further discussion on House Bill 3338? Hearing none, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 3338.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates is supposed to be here at 2:15, 2:30. We haven't reached him yet, so.
All right.
Well, we have Mr. Sager in residence. We could ask him to start begin his explanation of House Bill 2214. Members are ready to keep rolling here. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2214. And Mr. Olson will explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Members of the committee, we heard this bill on Wednesday, and Mr. Sager's back if there's any additional questions. Before you is the -2 amendment, which replaces the entire text of the bill. This bill directs the Legislative Assembly to appropriate a public education programs, funds, and agencies amount that is not less than 61% of projected revenues in the general fund, beginning with the 2007-2009 biennium. Requires the subsequent biennial appropriation for each program, fund, or agency be not less than 110% of the amount appropriated for the prior biennium. Limits the amount of monies that may be appropriated to the state school fund. Directs the Legislative Assembly to distribute amount above 10% growth to the Education Opportunity and Innovation Fund and the Education Stability Fund. It establishes the Education Opportunity and Innovation Fund and the pre-kindergarten through grade 12 successful schools account within the fund, and continuously appropriates money in the account to the Department of Education for grants to school districts, establishes the post-secondary academic and workforce investment account within the Education Opportunity Innovation Fund, continuously appropriates monies in the account for distribution to higher education purposes, directs the joint boards to adopt rules, and directs the Department of Administrative Services to prepare computations and estimates of revenue, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. The -2, which we also discussed on Wednesday, replaces the entire text, adds a floor of, quote, no less than 80% of the monies determined to be sufficient for that biennium by the Quality Education Commission must be appropriated for the state school fund. It deletes a baseline amount of $5.36 million to the state school fund. Changes the name of the pre-kindergarten through grade 12 successful school account to the school improvement account, and clarifies the formula for K-12 and post-secondary funds distribution, as well as distribution of funds from the school improvement account. This has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, yesterday in committee, we had the benefit of two charts from Mr. Sager, and I want to make sure that each one of our members does have
Is there still something like that 61% in the dash twos?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, the 61% stays, as does the 110%. It just adds the additional floor of 80% of the quality education model.
I do have a question. We tend to think of the budget we act on as general fund budget, but in fact the budget we act on is general fund plus lottery. This 61% isn't 61%. What do we have this year? About 15 billion or something? It's not 61% of that 15 billion, is it? It's 61% of a piece of that 15 billion, is that?
As you say, Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, I actually appreciate this question because it took me the longest time to figure out that we have in the state a difference between general fund revenue and general fund resource. General fund revenue are personal and corporate income taxes, and that is what the governor has been focused on, the 61%. General fund resources include lottery and other funds, so you're right. It's 61% of the smaller number, the revenue number, which is projected, I think our projection is $12.667 billion for general fund revenue.
Yeah, out of about 15 plus or minus total. So we were trying, Representative Clement and I were trying to make the 61% work with regard to the how much we actually have.
Right.
What's 61% of what we have in general fund revenue in this budget coming up? Well, 61% of 12.
No, the 61%.
7 billion.
Right. The 61% of 12,667, which is the current forecast, is $7.727 billion. So in the one chart that I gave you that has the breakdown for the K-12 numbers, if you look at the very top line under 0709, there's the 12,667 number. That's the most recent projection, and then we call out what the 61% would be as the minimum.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Representative Dolan.
I'm looking, Mr. Shager, at page 2, line 8 and 9, and it's the 61% again. Can you make that absolutely clear for me? The bill says 61% of the projected revenue. Why are we not including the whole thing?
Prospective general fund revenue.
Yes.
And that's, I mean, our overall budget is made up of general fund revenue and lottery revenue. Mm-hmm. That's what we call general fund, but it's really both those sources. This is only talking about the one source of funds.
But where does it say that?
Revenue. It says general fund revenue. In the overall budget, the general fund revenue and lottery revenue that goes into the mm-hmm. budget. This is just talking about the general fund revenue as a part of that total amount.
Okay.
Sure.
And that's absolutely true, everyone, because I've never been in the dark hole.
No, it wasn't clear to me last week. Yeah. I've been puzzling at it, then I figured out what it was.
Let's give the city one more.
Well, Chair Buckley, I'm sorry, but this was confusing to me. That's why I know where you're at on this. The word revenue is the key. And so that is why it's specified in here. It's general fund revenue. And that only includes the income tax from personal and corporate income taxpayers. It does not include lottery. When the budget is actually put together, so this is for purposes of the formula, when the budget is actually put together, the legislature can choose to pay that amount from any source that they want to. But for the purposes of the calculation, we use the general fund revenue base and we apply the 61% factor to that to give you the total dollar amount we have to come up with from whatever revenue sources.
So the lottery revenues aren't considered, quote, in the general fund.
No. Chair Buckley, no. They're general fund resources. And I'm sorry, I'm not the technical expert. This is all that's been told me. They are general fund resources, and the legislature distributes those. What is viewed as general fund revenue.
The way the bill's written, if I might, it doesn't say general fund revenues. It just says projected revenues in the general fund.
The word revenues, though, is
revenues
versus resources is the key?
Correct. That, again,
Representative Riley's straight talk police are about to show up here.
Plain talk.
Plain talk.
Thank you. Any further questions? Our purpose here is to make sure we fully get the idea. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank Mr. Sager for spending time with me to clarify that so I understand it fully. I'm sorry that you didn't have the opportunity of his advice to me, and I fully understand that, and I will remain supportive. I would kindly ask that, and we talked about this, but I didn't make it firm, I would like to see maybe a Section 12 or something that the Education Systems Design Team will develop a plan to provide accountability for the expenditure of these funds or something along that line. We're talking about how we're going to appropriate a lot of money, and I'm fine with that right now. But I think just a reference or some sort of referral to how we're going to do the accountability of all those funds for the taxpayers. I would appreciate if we could discuss that or talk about that. But we're in work session, I believe, right?
We are. Mr. Sager.
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, the governor wouldn't have any objection to putting in some sort of reference like that. Part of the reason that it was not included in the bill is because, in fact, that is the process that the legislature goes through when we go through the Ways and Means process. Let's talk about those. And I could I can clearly see how this, especially since we just talked about 3338, where the process could be pulled together and aligned more fully. I'm not sure if we have it in this bill, but we have to talk to you about
it. Representative Clem?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. I mentioned this the other day, but I had a conversation with some Marion County legislators this morning and folks from the Relief Nurseries and Healthy Start Program. Do you feel like this A, line 9, page 1, Oregon pre-kindergarten programs leaves enough room that if I want to come and start building the case that Healthy Start is also a pre-kindergarten program that, you know, gets kids ready for school, that we might be able to still have that conversation because this language is sort of vague, doesn't say Head Start?
Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, and I'm sorry, right off the top of my head, I can't remember if the Healthy Start funds are go through the grant and aid process through the Department of Ed or if they're in the DHS budget.
Commission on Children and Families.
Or Commission on Children and Families. And because see, those are funds that flow through the commission, through contract services, through the county. And so it's just the system is set up quite differently. Clearly, as the focus of the governor has been to make sure that the entire education system is supported, which is why he's been so clear on, first of all, Oregon Pre-K Head Start, which is the collaborative, and expanding those opportunities. Down the road to have those kinds of conversations would not prohibit us from doing that, the legislature from dealing with it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little curious. Does the governor really believe that we should have put $7.7 million in the K-12 school budget this year?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlee, the proposal is not to put 7.7. That 61%, the 7.7 is for the entire education enterprise.
Okay.
Okay, and so then that's what fair. You see below are the amounts that go to K-12, of which it would be the first gray bar, the 5985, and then the second gray bar, the 260. That's the co-chair's number.
So, which is the co-chair's number?
The two, the combining the 5985 and the 260, that's the 6245 that is in the co-chair's budget.
645. Is that in this chart?
Yes, sure. If you add 5985
right.
plus 260.
Okay.
And so what the... So we've used that number in here for the purpose of illustrating what the impact of this system is.
And that's the number that was in the governor's budget?
The governor's budget originally was $6.06 billion total. We had $6 billion on the first line, where you see the 595, and we had, and the governor had $60 million to start the Successful Schools Fund. I've simply adjusted this to reflect the co-chair's number.
Thank you.
There's trouble.
That's your comp.
Mr. Sager, could you talk to me about the future? I wish we all had a crystal ball. In the next column down on that same chart, it shows a projected growth rate of 23.8%.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Can you help me stay?
In the 2009-2011 biennium.
Okay. Second line.
Up on top. I see.
Up on top there. And my concern is if we have a projected growth that, well, my concern is the long term, and if this is an appropriation that's going to, as somebody definitely said the other day, I think as Representative Dahl, how is this going to impact corrections and health care?
Chair Buckley, Representative Kump, thank you for that question, too, because... again, these are numbers that are given to us from the Legislative Revenue Office. The reason for, if you'll notice under 0709, you have a 2.1% growth,
mm-hmm.
and then a 23.8%. That is the effect on general fund revenue caused by the kicker. So that it appears that for general fund revenue calculations, there's very little growth, but because that payment comes out of those revenues, and then it appears as this huge jump in the next biennium because you're not paying it out. It's there because it's in the projection. So what these numbers are projecting, this is based on current revenue forecasts. And so
okay.
And so on.
So track that a little further. So if you took the kicker amount out of there, what would be the projected growth rate for 09 and 11?
Chair Buckley, Representative Kump, I'd have to ask the Revenue Department to make that adjustment back, but it would have been
the average of those two numbers.
Yeah, it would have been more
two and the
12-13% range.
Oh.
But that is the anomaly. This is another problem with talking about revenue versus resources. It's an anomaly of the revenue. And so, again, these are the projections based on the current revenue forecasts out through the 11-13 biennia. And then in doing these calculations, I had asked Paul Warner from the Legislative Revenue Office to give me a number that would be sluggish, wouldn't be overly optimistic as far as growth, and that's what the 10.2% growth rate is, in order to make sure that this is sustainable and isn't subject to a sluggish economy problems.
Thank you.
Representative Dahl.
I'd like to go back to the line 9. When you say Oregon pre-kindergarten programs, I think this is somewhat like the line on page 2. That has a definite meaning in education. It defines programs presently offered pre-kindergarten, and I don't think healthy kids is in that definition at all.
I don't think it's healthy start.
President Dahl, you're correct. My point being that because we're putting this into statute, there would be nothing that would prevent the legislature to add an additional component if we felt that that should be included as part of the education enterprise, and we recognize it as a part. The governor, again, has focused on Head Start because historically it has been viewed as a social service program, and the governor's strongly convinced that it is a vital part of our education system.
Mr. Chair, I might follow up. You triggered a question for me.
Representative Clem.
So is there somewhere else where Oregon pre-kindergarten programs is defined then? Is that what you were saying?
Early childhood intervention.
Members, I do appreciate Mr. Sager's time. We do have this scheduled for next Wednesday, and Mr. Sager, I'm going to speak on your behalf and let the committee know that he is available to answer any additional questions you have on this bill. I just wanted to make sure we had a chance to kind of do a little bit of the overview for it, and we'll come back this next Wednesday. Thank you for your time, Mr. Sager. I'm going to close the public hearing on House 2214, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill. I'm sorry, I'm closing the work session on 2214. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2769. And I'm going to pass the gavel to Vice Chair Gollum and let Mr. Olson explain the bill. And I'll join Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2769 specifies the method for calculating amounts to be distributed to community college districts and community college service districts from the Community College Support Fund. It continuously appropriates monies in the fund to the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, declares an emergency, and is effective July 1st, 2007. Although I accidentally neglected to note it on the staff measure summary, it does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
2769, is that one?
Yes, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Vice Chair Dahl. I'm going to, of course, give courtesy to my esteemed colleague and my highly respected state senator, and offer him the chance to open with comments on this bill.
Why are you sucking up? Is there something?
He knows where I live, Representative.
I don't know why. You get the free tickets to the Sphinx Bear Festival. Chair Dallum and members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. This is a fairly simple bill, but it is dealing with a very thorny and not simple problem. I'm going to try to walk through it real quick with you where we're at and what needs to happen.
Can we introduce ourselves?
I'm Senator Alan Bates, and I'm a state senator from District 3 down in Southern Oregon. House Bill 2769 addresses what many of us consider an inequity in the current community college funding formula. This has been a problem for years, continues to be a real problem for many of us. This bill simply removes consideration of local property taxes when distributing state dollars to community colleges. In essence, what it does is that every general fund dollar that is allocated to community colleges simply follows the student. In 2004, the State Board of Education, at the recommendation of the community college presidents, included consideration of local property taxes collected for community college when distributing general fund dollars. They wanted to be a mixture of those two. This practice resulted in areas with high property taxes receiving less general fund dollars per student than areas with lower taxes. Now, I'm going to go through that again. Areas that have higher property taxes receive less general fund dollars per student than areas with lower local taxes.
Is that higher property taxes generally, or higher property taxes toward supporting the community college?
In our particular area, we have the state average for local taxes. With a mill rate, that's the average for the state. But for our mill rate for our community college, it's higher than the average for the state.
So in a district like Portland that has the maximum allowable, and the community college runs up against that allocation formula, it might get less than the average state.
I would tell you that that's the decision Portland has to make and how they want to distribute their dollars. how they want to distribute dollars is up to them.
Right, I'll follow up.
They also have a situation in Portland where you have many large industrial bases that other parts of the state, especially rural parts, do not have. It isn't simply residential property. Where communities have stepped up to support their local community colleges through higher mill rates and higher property taxes, such as Rural Community College, mine, in Southern Oregon, an actual decrease in general fund dollars has occurred with enrollment increases. In 2003, there has been, since 2003, there has been a 13% increase in general fund dollars to community colleges. Rogue Community College during that time has experienced a 16% decrease in general fund dollars during that time. I don't like to compare this to K-12 because I don't think it's a comparable situation. In the community college system, a student can move anywhere in the state they want to and within 90 days are accepted as a local student. They don't have to get an okay from their district to move. They don't have to get a transfer from the district to move. They can simply move and take advantage of any system they want to anywhere in the state. What we are doing essentially in many ways is punishing good behavior and rewarding bad behavior. It has reached an extreme now that in some areas, such as Bend, they are talking about leaving the system entirely. They feel they'll do better with just their own local property taxes, give up the general fund dollars altogether, because in a couple of years, the way this form is set up, they will actually be subsidizing the other community colleges with their local property taxes. That's how perverse this thing has gotten. Our particular community college is a few years behind that. We think it's about 6 years out before that occurs, at which point we would probably be forced to leave the system also. I think we have a responsibility to deal with this in a fair way. What I'm asking for here is a dollar-for-dollar transfer. I would also be very accepting if it's just an adjustment of the formula so nobody loses on this thing. That has not been forthcoming. What has happened, and I'll be blunt about this, I've talked to a couple of the community college presidents in private where they feel they can speak to me and they don't want their names used here. They've been told, if you mess with this formula, you will pay a price. You will pay a price. You vote with us on this formula or you will pay a price. I don't like that kind of stuff going on. I don't like my president or other presidents being bullied by the other presidents. They need to come up with a better formula, one that's fair. There are a lot of issues here, but I would offer that any time we are increasing the amount of money we're giving to community colleges, and some community colleges are in a situation where the actual money they receive doesn't increase as fast as others, but in fact goes down, and they are considered leaving the system, we got a real problem. Here's the other things going on in my community. There's people in my community now talking about changing our mill rate. They want to go back to the people and say, we're going to lower the mill rate for our community college. And why shouldn't they? I have a hard time arguing against that. We'll lower our mill rate so we don't have as much local money going to our community college, and then we'll draw down more general fund money. I think that's the wrong thing to be doing. They want to transfer that into general fund money for our county because we've lost our O&C funds. Now, that's the kind of things that happen when we have a perverse system going on. This can be resolved in two ways. We can pass this bill out, or the community college presidents can sit down and come up with a fairer formula. There have been a couple of them offered. They have not been accepted at this point. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Cole.
Thank you, Chair Dahl. Help me out, Senator Bates. What's mill rate?
You get charged. The amount of property tax collected is a result of two different things. One, a mill rate. So much per thousand of value of property is called the mill rate.
That's what I was thinking,
yeah.
But I just wanted to clarify.
But against that is you have communities that have extremely high property values boosting up Bend and Medford.
Yeah, I understand how those two work together. It's inverting it, but mm-hmm. I didn't. I wanted to make sure that word mill meant per thousand.
To be perfectly honest, the situation, if I can, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I'm not against a formula that helps some more than others. That needs to happen. There are some rural, very rural community colleges that have a reasonable rate, and yet their property values are so low they can't very well support a community college. I can look at a situation like Multnomah County where they have a pretty high rate, and they can't really raise it much more. I wouldn't mind them getting a little more from general fund money. They also make the case that you have higher income taxes being paid in that county than other taxes, too. I'm okay with that. I'm not okay with community colleges actually losing money and thinking about leaving the system. That's what has to be fixed.
But just for the record, this bill would take about $5 million a biennium out of the Portland Community College budget. and Portland is at a high tax rate, but the problem is the squish of all the things that are in the tax rates are a component of community college is restricted, even though the tax rate is as high. It's at the maximum level it can be. So, I mean, the problem is, in the political system, there are winners and there are losers. And that's always a bit of a problem.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to respond if I could. And I agree, there are winners and losers. And I've already said that I'm willing to accept a different formula. At least I've got somebody's attention with this. Because what's going to happen is they're all going to leave the system. The losers are going to leave the system. And maybe that's what they want to have happen, because then they get all the general fund money for certain community colleges, and the ones that left the system get nothing. But they need to keep their own property taxes. The way it's set up now, they're going to start losing property taxes to the general system. If that happens, you're going to have an evaporation of community colleges coming to us in the legislature and speaking as one voice to us. Okay, it's going to be a mess. They need to change this formula.
Representative, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate this. And we had actually a similar, really similar philosophical basis behind something, but we didn't really have this deep of a discussion on that other bill that we had on local options and property taxes for the K-12 arena. So I see Ashland represented here again now in the community college arena talking about the same basic issue. And that's a totally fair conversation. I guess what I don't know just procedurally about community colleges is is our current formula do it on sort of the same equalized basis that we're talking about in K-12, where Oregon income taxpayers pay into income taxes and it goes back out on a per student basis no matter where you go, completely fairly, and then the effect of that is something that you don't like, but the philosophy behind it is we all pay in and it all goes out.
No, it's the opposite.
Representative,
yeah, it's the opposite. In the state formula, it starts with how much you put in, and then you end up with an equalized amount by adding state funds to top off whatever it is the local property tax produces. And in the community colleges, the formula specifically goes equal to everybody without regard to how much property tax they earn. So the argument is that the people that put more property tax in aren't getting the benefit of that property.
But it goes back out on an equal basis. It's been made equal, though, by property taxes, so less income taxes will go to certain areas than others because the property taxes were higher?
No, the formula that's being proposed is... Yeah, all right, I have it wrong. The formula that's being proposed takes out the property tax, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had it backwards. No, you're right, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, the formula is draconian from the other direction. It says, because I don't believe this functions the way a K-12 system functions, students can move. And in 90 days, they become a resident of whatever junior college district they're in, or you know, a community college district. I don't think it's the same. You can't compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges here. However, I also said, I believe you do need a form that's not purely dollar for dollar, unless you have to. Because what you've got now is a situation that, to a certain degree, it all goes into one pot. And if you have me putting in more in that pot than the next district, to an amount that, such that your property taxes are actually going to go to other areas in the state, because you get no general fund dollars, and you're actually putting money in that's being siphoned off to other districts, and that's ready to happen and bend, and those people in that community are going, why am I supporting my community college? And they're going to figure it out pretty quick. They're starting to already in my area. And they're talking about, let's just pull that rate back down and put the money somewhere else, or get rid of it entirely. We don't want that to happen.
I think Senator Biggs has already figured it out. The conversation may not have gone as far as you, but I think Representative Roosevelt and I can both attest to the fact that the Central Oregon Community College is very similarly situated. I would really like to... Do we have somebody here that knows the formula? It appears as though...
If I may, if you do have any, I'll be very brief, because I do want to let the folks in the community colleges speak this as well. I'd just like to... Senator Bates is, for record, Representative Peter Buckley, South Jackson County. Senator Bates has made most of the points I think are important to make. I would just like to emphasize again, people look at, you know, the represents in Ashland, Rural Community College is not in Ashland, it's in Medford and it's in Grants Pass as well. There's a perception that Jackson, Josephine counties, or at least Ashland, is a wealthy area. Jackson, Josephine counties have poverty rates of 12.5% and 15%. Poverty rates that high
those are well over the statewide rate of 11.6%. But our counties have stepped forward and said, we will make this investment in our community colleges. All we're asking is not to be punished for this. And there are winners and losers in every system. I totally agree. But in terms of education, it should never be winner-take-all. It should never be that students in one part of the state are so severely penalized. Even with the $483 million provided in the governor's recommended budget for community colleges, RCC still would have lost at that level. They would have had to cut 32 positions, reduce program offerings, and raise tuition yet again. We are in, with RCC, a situation where declining enrollment is happening because of the ever-rising increasement of the tuition costs and the cutting back of programs. We're in one of those spirals where rural community colleges is in tremendous difficulty right now. And unless we can get some sort of adjustment on this, this is crucial to rural community college. It's not my college. It's Jackson County, Adjustment County College. I'm here to speak on its behalf. And Lane College is also hit, as well as Central Oregon. So I do want to give time to the other folks as well. And thank you for your...
Well, I think we do have a question before you. We have a question at the end of the table. Representative Wilmot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Here.
Thank you. Senator and Representative, God bless you. Good bill. Let's pass it today.
Right now. Is there a question in there, Representative?
Don't you think?
Mr. Chair.
We have follow up.
I think both of both the Senator and Representative brought up some good points. We're not uneducated in Central Oregon, and we know this is not right. It is not fair. We have been promised since I walked in the halls of this great building that this issue would be addressed. It has not been addressed. I didn't know we were going to go public, but yes, and why would you be a member of something that you're not getting any benefit from it, including talking about state funds? Central Oregon even goes further because we believe in community colleges, and it's not the same as K-12. They're different purposes, have different needs. We've even passed another tax on top of what we're paying now for community colleges, which goes back into the system. And that has not been addressed. It has not been addressed in the 4 years I've been in this building. The presidents of community colleges keep saying they're going to work out a deal, they're going to work out a deal. It has not been done, and the time is now to address this issue, or I guess it's out of the bag. We're not going to stay part of the state system. Maybe that will create more fun for the state system. But not much, because you're not giving us anything.
Thank you. President Cobb.
Actually, first of all, thank you. Your point is really fair. I mean, I'm new to the whole local option debate, and community college districts are much larger than what we heard about from the superintendent of the Ashland area on the other issue. Here's my problem. I'm just thinking about a person like myself. I pay income taxes. I have no children. I don't pay into school districts. I don't pay into. I don't receive benefits directly to my family from a community college or a K-12. I receive benefits as part of having a better society in general and a better state of Oregon. I pay income taxes into a system, and because I have no stake in the game, whether it goes to Salem as a taxpayer, Salem, Grants Pass, wherever, I don't care. I want Oregonians educated. Why is that philosophy that my income tax dollars should be done on a formula anything other than wherever the student is? The student, I don't know if I'm making myself clear. If the formula has regional disparities on the income tax side, why would we adjust that? Because the philosophy is the taxpayers, the income tax dollar that goes in should go out on an equalized basis.
That's the basis of our bill. It's not income tax, especially Chair Dahlman or Central. It's property tax that is part of the formula. Our counties are paying higher property tax into our community college district. So not only is our income tax going into the system, but our property taxes are going into the system. And as Senator Bates explained, Representative Wilson has explained, we're at a point now where it's almost a point where we are paying our property taxes to a point where it'd be better off for us to reduce our own property taxes in order to bring in a fair distribution of income taxes into the community college system.
For my follow-up, do you then give up the income taxes if you, quote, pull out of the system?
Yes, we would. Because it's reached a point, Mr. Chair and Representative Clem, it's reached a point for one community college, a real next biennium, and for us in two bienniums if things continue this way, that we will actually then start losing our local property taxes into the whole system, and we're better off being out and just keeping our property taxes.
Okay, I'm just helping me understand this. So then I guess I go back to why, if I don't actually use the Chemeketa Community College district, I live in that district, but I don't actually use the services. Is that our system, though, where your property taxes are only supposed to feed your local district? Because I really don't care where my property taxes go. I just want them to be used for community colleges around the state. So I don't mind that my property taxes go into formula. I don't think about the benefits of community colleges to our state as a regional sort of taxing district issue. I think about them as a greater good. It's the whole education enterprise concept. I think about higher ed the same way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, I'm going to make your life a little harder. I'm sorry. Okay.
It's totally fair. I mean,
because I'm going to be totally fair about this. Yeah. There are regional differences in our state.
There are significant
regional differences in our states, different parts of our state, and community colleges represent some of those differences. There are some very rural community colleges that have a very difficult time being maintained at all if they weren't receiving, I would call it, a disproportionate share of the income tax. I don't have a problem with that. Portland Community College might have a problem if it weren't getting a disproportionate share of the income tax. Okay? This sounds bizarre. I'm arguing against my own bill here for a second. Okay? Because they have a high tax rate there already, and there just isn't enough to cover all their services. So you don't want to lose your community college in Portland either. Okay? Having said that, the way the form has been set up and the inability of the college presidents to sit down and come to a rational, fair program that recognizes those regional differences and accounts for those regional differences is what's brought us here today. When you reach a point in your formula that one community college is ready to leave the system, that certain communities are willing to drop their levy rate to either bring down more revenue or leave the system also, then something is very perverse. And you've got a form that doesn't work anymore.
If I could just really quickly respond, I don't care where my property taxes go either. If every community college in the state actually had the funding that it needs to run its programs and serve its students. What we have now is a formula that allows some community colleges to run programs and serve the students at a level far beyond other community colleges, no matter what scale those sizes community colleges are. All we're asking is to make sure that Rural Community College, Lane, Central Oregon, the community colleges that are the losers in this formula are addressed so that they can offer the services that their students deserve just the same as any other community college. I'm glad to pay my property taxes for the system as a whole.
If I get to offer one more point?
I need to go next door to church.
I'd like to get our next witnesses up. And I think
I've got a meeting I have to go to. I'm sorry.
Senator, if you make your comment very brief, we'll slip it in. And then I'd like to bring the other witnesses to the chair.
One of the comments you're likely to hear, and I've heard, is it just gave us more money, we can make everybody a winner. And unfortunately, I don't think it's likely to happen, all right? And I don't want a formula that takes more money to make everybody a winner. I want a formula, no matter what the amount of money is out there, that everybody's a little bit of a winner and that nobody has an actual drop in general fund money while others are going up. That form has been talked about and discussed, and we can't get any traction on it. So the alternative is you know, run a bill out, make it a dollar for a dollar. At least we're getting their attention. Or if they won't come to the table on this, and I recommend we run the bill out and use this formula. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you, Representative Buckley. I'd like to thank you, Senator. I'm going to bring the next three witnesses up, and I'm going to.
If I had a chance to answer the question, I'll just be a straight no. It's no problem.
Well, I'm going to give you an opportunity while we.
No, you're not.
You're not going to take the opportunity. If we could have our next three witnesses so we can look at the formula.
Thank you, Senator Bates. We can run a little bit over three if with your indulgence. Yeah, we have some wisdom camp, but I think he's already got an opinion on this bill.
Mr. Chair, the one thing, and I've heard some of this testimony, and I'd encourage Representative Clem. Community colleges are different. They're addressing community needs and different programs. It costs different money. So the community colleges are not like the cases. And the other thing is, when I first learned about this system,
this system of distribution of money takes no account of the tuition. And you've got tuition maybe $5 or $6 a difference per hour. So you know if you're trying to look at what's best for the students, you've got to look at the whole financial picture.
Thank you, Representative.
I have a comment that I really want to make, but I see three people that know far more than I do. My comment will save for another day, but I would like to hear from the three experts on the stand. I'll give you the gavel back, and for myself, I will stay.
Thank you. Welcome, please. Whichever order you'd like to go in is fine.
Well, I think we just introduce ourselves. I'm Jerry Berger. I'm the chair of the State Board of Education.
Lyndon Wise, member of the State Board of Education.
Kim Porcelli, commissioner for community colleges.
President Dolan talked earlier about the first bill you heard about the person that lives in the rural area wants to move to the urban area. My thought when I looked outside was, I've made a mistake. I need to leave the urban area and go to the rural area. So there's two ways of looking at that. We're here representing the State Board of Education. We are not here as individuals. So this is a State Board of Education presentation or our views. So I wanted to clarify that. We're not here as individuals. We are here as our role as chair and vice chair of the State Board of Education. The State Board of Education is responsible for pre-K through 12 and community colleges. So the State Board of Education is looking at that sector of K through 14. When you look at the sectors as just one block by itself, it has a whole different conclusion you come to. Duncan's going to give some information regarding Measure 5, where basically K through 14 system was reduced from as high as $22, $23 per thousand to $5 per thousand. That's shared statewide for K through 14. In fact, in individual community college districts, you have different rates that people pay into the community college fund or to the K through 12 fund and the ESD funds. It's a moving target even within. People are paying different dollars for community colleges within, say, a Chemeketa district in Sheridan than they may be in Staten. And the same thing is true of K through 12 or ESDs, because those are the people in that $5 per thousand. But statewide, people, taxpayers, are paying on their property tax no more than $5 per thousand. And in the community college district, I don't know if we have anybody that got a supplemental levy past that to support community colleges.
Local option.
There's a local option, but I don't believe anyone has done a local option. So from the statewide perspective, when you look at both K through 12 and community colleges, they're sharing the $5 per thousand that statewide people get. So you might, to use the term, you might lose on the community college end, but you might gain on the K through 12 end, because dollars are distributed differently. Let me give you a brief. So we are representing the State Board of Education. We are not representing community colleges, and we're not representing K through 12. We're representing the State Board of Ed. We did have in 2005, and this discussion regarding funding has been going on since Measure 5 passed. And that's a long time ago. That's in 1990. So it's not nothing. And the passion regarding it, I have seen before in other jobs and positions, etc. In early 2005, the State Board of Education asked the commissioner to work with partners regarding looking at the funding formula and trying to put it, and we had community college presidents, business officers, faculty, we had a board member, state board, a community college board member, State Board of Education member that worked for at least 6 months regarding this, looking at spreadsheets, who gets hurt, who doesn't get hurt, etc., and tried to come up with a formula. That was given to the State Board of Education. The presidents did not adopt the funding formula, the state board distribution formula. The State Board of Education adopted a distribution formula, and we adopted that in June of 2005. The concepts behind that that we used, the State Board of Education used, to try to look at this, is we basically came that the thing must be student-centered. Dollars should follow the students. It's dollars and students and equitability throughout the state. So access and equity. That was a huge goal. That was, we gave the task force, we gave the people working on that, that access, a commitment to access and equity, no matter where they attended the community college. We did focus on the money going with students and not necessarily the money going to institutions, because we have some institutions getting more dollars than other institutions getting, actually providing similar services. So there is still, and we said we do need to equalize that, as K through 12 did early in the 1990s on funding, because everybody had different rates throughout the state on the K through 12 funding. Community colleges never did that. And then never was appropriated money to do that. So we also had a commitment to high level of services to current students. We did not want to put institutions at risk. We wanted to protect institutions, and we developed some safeguards so current students just wouldn't be ripped out of programs, et cetera, et cetera. And we also were after long-term predictability and some stability. Now, long-term predictability and stability, as you well know of what we happened in the last, the recession in Oregon, that didn't help long-term predictability and stability. That downturn hurt a lot of institutions, agencies, et cetera, in Oregon. So that's always hard to predict. But we used the policy levers. We had a base. We've heard comments regarding some. We do have a base for our, what I'd call our small community colleges, a 1,400 FTE base that they get, even if they don't have 1,400 FTE. So there's a safety net for our small institutions that they will get that, even if they only have 800. Now, I don't know how many we have left in the 1,400, but we do have some left under the 1,400, so we're trying to protect the rural areas. We also use a three-year weighted average on FTE. So maybe an institution loses 10% this year of enrollment. They don't take that hit in that 10%. It's a rolling average, which is built in to protect the stability of the institution. So an institution can react to that, make the changes, the modification, or whatever. The thing that's so difficult to track when you look at it is enrollment or lack of enrollment has huge impact on institutions. And if you track over the 3 years of who's gained, who's lost, etc., you have some interesting things that impact that because of enrollment growth and lack of growth. Just take a look at Premier Portland Community College. They're 25% of the FTE. If they grew, say, 10% in 1 year and it wasn't a buffer, they could gobble up a lot of money. We won't allow that to occur. We have a buffer there that takes a three-year average. So that's a lever. And the other lever was the concept of equalization. Community college has been fighting since Measure 5 regarding the funding formula. And we felt, as a state board, that if we don't equalize sometime, we're going to be fighting forever, forever, and forever regarding that. So equalization was something, and we phased that in. We're phasing that in over 6 years. We also put into the commissioner's funds dollars to assist institutions of what I'd call, we have a term, I'm trying to, where we can help. Tillamook Bay, for example, was given $500,000, $750,000, even with the 1,400 K cap. We gave them dollars because they were hit with some unexpected things, and if the commissioner didn't, came to the board, gave the option, and they got more dollars than the formula allowed. So we built in some protections on extreme, you know, extra unintended consequences of formula, et cetera, that, so they did get dollars to get over the hurdle. So I think that's enough, and if my voice were, I hope I'm not too passionate. I'm trying to be not passionate, but if you know me, that's difficult for me to do.
Passion's already been brought up.
Yes. So we did have, and I'm really, it would be a shame if we had community college presidents who got intimidated.
That would be true.
I know the State Board of Education does not operate on that principle. I need to say that. I was a community college president at two institutions, and my commissioner never intimidated me. Maybe it's me. I would hate to be a president that would tell somebody I'm intimidated. But that's getting too passionate. So I'd like to turn it over to Duncan.
Thank you, Mr.
on consequences and some concerns. And I gave more than I was going to do, Duncan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know time is short here, so let me be brief. Again, Duncan Wise, member of the board. We did take a position today. We recommend that you not adopt this bill. I think it raises some very fundamental questions, both about governance and the policy associated with it. The first point I want to stress is the presidents don't set the formula. The state board does. The buck stops right now with the state board. We decide how the funds are going to be distributed. And as Jerry pointed out, we set out on a journey to rethink the funding formula. I think a process that I think was fair and with a lot of wrestling. We heard what you've just heard. We heard a lot of voices around the formula about fairness and unfairness. And fairness, obviously, in many respects, is in the eye of the beholder. And we had to think about the broad policy direction for the state that we wanted to take around community college funding as we adjusted to what we consider now equalization. Again, the context of this is really important. Measure 5 changed everything. Local districts no longer establish how much money they're going to get from their schools. You do. The legislature does. You ultimately decide both the level of funding that's going to be available for both K-12 and the community college budget. When you took that responsibility in the case of K-12 in the early 90s, you had to decide, once you said we've got to come up with a certain amount of money for the K-12 system, and you decided how to distribute it, your revenue committee made a critically important, and I would argue a terribly courageous decision. You decided that you were going to equalize based on dollars per student, looking at property tax and state revenues, the income tax, and distribute it on that basis statewide. And you decided, and again, I think with the understanding that if you're going to set the funding level, the local property tax is just one component of the total funding level for the K-12 system. And over a five-year period, you adjusted the funding to fully equalize statewide. I can tell you that had huge impacts on K-12 systems around the state. Huge impacts in that. And again, I would argue it was courageous, very, very important. And today we went from the most unequally funded system of education in K-12 in the nation to the most equalized system. We have not done that in community colleges yet. But I would argue the same principles apply. There's a limit on local property tax at $5 per thousand. Some districts had a higher amount of proportion of that property tax in the community college. When Measure 5 passed, some had a higher proportion in K-12. All districts, everybody, all of us, basically pay $5 per thousand for K-12 and community colleges in Oregon. That's and there may be maybe one exception in the state, but basically everybody is in that condition. So the question is, you know, how, given that and that you're setting the total funding levels, how do we distribute? We concluded the fairest way to distribute is dollars per student, looking at the total of dollars available, and that's the journey we're on. And we're trying to adjust it. We've been really working with the committee to try to do it in as fair a way as we can. But that's the underlying philosophy. And once we're equalized, then I think that sets up
a much better policy framework for talking about how we invest in both community college and K-12 education. It allows us then to look at targeted programs, to make adjustments as we do now for rural districts. We obviously have adjustments to deal with, you know, changes in enrollments and making sure it's not to gradually make those adjustments, as Jerry mentioned. And so we have gone through this debate and discussion. We have made we are making the adjustments. We know certain schools are harmed, just like they were harmed when Measure 5 affected K-12. But I really believe that in the long run, you're going to have a much more equitable funding base for all of education in Oregon, and it will be a much better platform for making the policy judgments you need to be making around education funding. So we take our responsibilities very seriously. I would point out all the community college presidents signed a letter agreeing that the state board was the appropriate place for these decisions to be made. We take these responsibilities terribly seriously. We continually engage with the partners in the community on this and looking at our formulas. We'll continue to do that. But again, I would encourage you to leave this responsibility. You've charged us with responsibility. We take it seriously, and I hope you will let us continue to pursue this responsibility of distributing the funds for the community college system. Thank you.
Anything you'd like to add?
Mr. Chair, I'm here only as a technical expert.
Very good. I just did brief up the chair's prerogative to respond briefly. I appreciate your comments. I hope it's very clear that I'm looking at a community college, and I know that Representative Wisnett is as well. Maybe things, circumstances differ slightly, but I'm looking at a death spiral because the more we cut RCC and the higher we raise tuition, the fewer people enroll, which means the less money we get the next year, even though it's over the 3-year average. I totally understand that, but we're in a death spiral, and unless we find a way to pull out of it, we're in danger of not having the institution for our region, which is crucial, as you know. You know, it's crucial for our region. So I appreciate you being here to
listen. No, I hear you, and I thank you for sharing that. That's really important.
Can I have one comment before I have to leave?
Representative Allen?
I understand the State Board of Education problem. I also deeply understand Central Oregon Community College's problem when K-12 went into compression. That was me at Central Inn, and it is painful. And the only thing that prevented us from a death spiral is, by law, we had to stay open. it seems like, I don't know what kind of a formula you create where there's all winners. And if you do one, we're going to turn a lot more formulas over to you. I would like to ask this, so if the community colleges were funded at the $5.29 million level, would we then be able to offer them...
$5.29 million.
We'd offer them nothing. We'd offer them some help packing up.
if we had full funding of the community colleges as advanced in the governor's budget, would that help bring some relief to this problem for Rogue, for Central Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahl, the answer is yes, but it doesn't solve all the problems. With respect to Chair Buckley's college, they have lost enrollment. This formula reimburses on enrollment. And so they are less affected by the equalization piece of this formula than they are the enrollment piece. Central is a different animal. They are more affected by equalization, although the board has a harm limit that they set every year at 3%. Right now it's set at 3%, so no institution will lose more than 3% of its revenue because of equalization. We don't have the same stopgap for enrollment. Never went there. But certainly Rogue Community College is not the only college that has lost enrollment. Tillamook Bay, as Chair Berger represented, has lost a considerable percentage of their enrollment. I think that's what I wanted to communicate.
I'd like to thank all three of you, and I'm going to have to excuse myself.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
President.
I just had a question. Someone had mentioned, I think Jerry, about the local option that no one's actually taken advantage of. If they did, would that all feed straight into the bigger formula as well?
Representative, Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, no. The formula is written specifically to allow, if a local option was passed by a community college, they could keep it all.
Well, and that's a, I don't even want to go there, explaining the local option, but are you familiar? It's a complicated question. It's a very limited local option, let's put it that way. Basically, it's very limited.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm kind of a, you know, I'm not a mathematician. I don't have a PhD in mathematics. And so formulas have always sort of gone over my head. And I think Senator Bates and Representative Buckley, in my way of thinking, were making a pretty clear argument about, and actually I would say it should appeal to K-12 also, as to why we shouldn't just make the formula with regards to the income tax dollars very simple. Amount of money divided by the number of students equals the per student funding. You have this number of students in your school, that's how much money you get. To me, they were making the argument pretty clear for K-12 as well, quite frankly, because I think my own personal opinion of the K-12 formula is that it sucks. And I don't know about the community college formula because I'm not as familiar with it. But my question is, why not have the formula just be very simple? That is, amount of money divided by the, in this case, instead of, because we only have 17 community colleges, amount of money divided by the number of community colleges, that's how much they get. And they can use it for their programs, and because they have the ability to get some property tax and pass bonds and that sort of thing, using that tool. And I understand the $5 per thousand, although I thought the community colleges were inside the $10 per thousand of local government, so I'm being correct on that. But I'm just curious about a thought on that. That way, every community college.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Crumbull, I mean, it really does get back to your notion of equity, especially after Measure 5. If you did that, obviously those property tax rich areas, that would be, say, Portland, would have an advantage over those who don't. I mean, because you've established a state level at $5 per thousand, there's no longer any local property tax choice at the local level, and so that would create a very, very unequal revenue system for the state based on essentially your local property tax base. And I think the legislature, as it thought about its responsibility for the total funding of education in Oregon, which it was given with Measure 5, whether voters decided that this is no longer a locally, this is not a locally driven revenue system anymore. I think what you decided was that you needed to think about the total revenue available, which includes local property tax, which is, we're all paying the same amount now, $5 per thousand. Some areas have more money, some have less. And there's no longer any local judgment on the local property tax amount for education. I mean, it is true what some of you say. In theory, you could adjust your, in the current system, you can adjust your community college property taxes down, I guess, and I mean, you can make adjustments within the K-12 community college in terms of the compression, but basically we're all paying $5 per thousand. So I think it's more equitable to consider those revenues as part of the overall resource available for education.
Chair Buckley and Representative Colonel, I think the board, basically, we do have in this state K-12 systems that don't get any money from the state.
That's correct.
In fact, the Dougherty and Seaside, as an example, gets almost none of, I think it's zero. No money, zero money from the state. And if you went to Seaside and looked at their $5 per thousand, they voted on so much for Clatsop. ESD gets some, and then the K-12 systems of the different schools there give so much. So the concept of that $5 per thousand, and then since they don't get any money from the state, their dollars go someplace else. That's the reality. And what the state board attempted to do is take a look at the policy adopted by the state, and then don't look at them as just individual things. We heard that you had the presentation from the governor's office regarding trying to look at this system in some way. And the state board, the concept was to look at citizens of Oregon and spread those resources in such a way, and your formula. So if somebody has huge amounts of money and the average cost is $3,500 per FTE, that's what they get. And they might then take their money and share it else. And that's happening in the state right now, especially in the K-12 system, because it's only a matter of what people voted on, because some schools perhaps didn't put enough into K-12. So then other cities and counties and said, paid real money out of K-12 because they didn't support K-12. And if you looked at it from 1990 on, you would see some amazing decisions made locally, and they've lost that under the Measure 5 that's out there.
I had a school district that was, and I apologize for kind of shifting this, but I had a school district that was penalized for 10 straight years with reduced spending per student, because prior to Measure 5, their community had really supported the school system.
That's it.
And if I'm Representative Buckley. And my view, it is not a rural-urban issue. It isn't that clean.
It's not, no.
It's not at all. People jump into and say, you're killing the rural, the small area, you're killing... It doesn't go out that way, because it just depends how they allocated that, what came $5 per thousand for those districts. It is not a rural... It's not a rural-urban issue on the funding pool.
It's not even necessarily a wealth issue either, since it's only $5 per thousand. It's just your priorities for how you spend your $5, but everyone's paying the same $5, so it's not like Lake Oswego, you know, versus Coos Bay when I was growing up, where it felt like they had everything, we had nothing, under a property tax scheme. And my question was going to be, can someone help me, I mean, Senator or Representative Greenlick seemed to know what happened in his community college district. You don't have to do it right now, but I'd like to know my district. My objection to this is completely philosophical. I might be arguing against the interests of my own district. I have no idea, but I have a deeply held philosophical belief about equal funding for any Oregon person trying to attend education, no matter where they are, regardless of who the constituents are, to be honest.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess the big question here, as I see it, what Measure 5 did, whether we like it or not, is bring us all together around one conversation about education funding in Oregon. And that may not be pleasant, and it was certainly not pleasant. As a person who lived in Portland during the K-12 equalization, it was not pleasant, because the many school districts in my region took a big hit while, we made adjustments. And that's frankly what we're experiencing to some degree, and we've been trying to temper it in the community college. But when we're done with equalization, we'll be in this together, per student, looking at all the resources and property tax and the income tax. And this, I'm going to make a pitch. This is probably not fair, which is exactly why you need to pass 3338, because you're in charge. You're in charge of figuring out how much money each part of these systems need, how much per student, and you need to be thin. And it's a critical policy role that you play, and we'll help you play it as you ask us to, because Measure 5 gave you became the place where the education funding decisions are made, and you need the tools. And again, I think we're taking our responsibility, but this really is the nature of the game we've created with Measure 5. And I think there's a lot of equity to it. I mean, I think there is some fairness to say that every student, regardless of where they live, with adjustments for rural and so on, deserve the same amount of money for education. I mean, there's some real equity in that.
One more question.
Yes, Adrian.
Thank you very much. It seems to me a lot of questions concerning the formula issue. And the K-12 formula, we legislators, we set the formula. It seems to me that the community colleges, the board, setting the formula.
Mm-hmm.
And how often do you set that formula? Do you use the same formula for five, once in a 5 years do you change the formula? How do you do that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lim, we have probably had five adjustments to the formula since Measure 5 passed. When Measure 5 first passed in the middle 90s, 50% of property taxes were considered in the distribution of the general fund monies that came. And over time, we kept moving more toward 100%, and it was actually a recommendation that came from the community college presidents in late 2003, early 2004, that 100% of property taxes should be considered in the formula, and that's when we began the process that Chair Berger spoke to you about. This formula that we have now has a six-year implementation timeline. We did it purposely, didn't want to go overnight like had happened to K-12, wanted to give colleges an opportunity to plan for what we know will be difficult times for some. But it was never contemplated, and I must put this on the record, it was never contemplated, nor is it part of the formula, that property taxes that are raised in a particular community college district would ever leave that district. So when you hear about Central Oregon Community College being concerned about being an independent entity rather than take state general fund, that may be their choice. Whether they do that or not, the formula that is currently in rule would not siphon off property taxes from them. It's not anticipated anywhere. We currently have a situation that, just to demonstrate the difference in numbers, Representative Dahlem represents Wasco County. They raise about $350,000 a year, maybe a little more now, for Hood River County in property taxes. They serve over 100 students in that area, in just that area. That $300,000 is not very much per student. Conversely, if you looked at Central Oregon Community College, they currently raise $1,000 more per student than the lowest property tax generating district, which is Umpqua Community College. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference of $4,000 that's available for a student that happens to live and go to school at Central Oregon Community College than a student that lives at Umpqua or in Roseburg and chooses to go to Umpqua Community College. And the board's decision is that it shouldn't be per chance where that student lives what kind of support they get. Therefore, the formula will slowly move those like Umpqua up and try very hard not to compress colleges such as Central Oregon down. But that's really the mechanics that we have going on. And to your earlier question, Representative Dahlem's question about the 529, the more money that is in the formula distribution model, the less the people have to come down because we have more money to bring the low liars up.
Okay. Yeah, follow up. Is it possible I can get a copy of the formula?
Sure.
And
absolutely.
In a simplest form so I can understand better.
That's enough for math.
Okay.
I just wanted to sort of get a double check on the philosophical discussion about K-12 versus community colleges, because we're kind of doing what K-12 did, it seems like, mm-hmm. Over time. And it seems to me from now sitting on what appears to be the big paycheck for schools, we have regional differences, as Senator Bates said, we have regional differences, but we account for that in both with regional school boards or community college boards. Mm-hmm. The funding in K-12 at least is no longer really regional at all, but the way the programs are delivered are set by local school boards. Same with community college board members come in here and fight very hard to maintain their regional autonomy for curriculums and programs and how to meet the needs of their particular region through what program offerings they have. But I just It seems to me they're very similar, actually, at this point, in the way it's set up. You had a local board and a state payer of checks.
Representative Buckley, Chair Buckley, Representative Clinton, community colleges in the present structure actually do get to make a lot of decisions regarding what programs they offer, whom they decide to serve, and there are elected officials in those areas. They have more autonomy, and they may, and some of them might add a program and it doesn't go, and they spent $200,000 and it was a bad business decision. They do have that authority. I'd hate to see that authority go away. However, when you make business decisions that don't pan out, it might have impact on your budget. And then you might have somebody making a decision on a budget, and then that president leaves or that board leaves and someone else inherits it. So it's a moving target, where in the K-12, you community college set tuition dollars. If you set it too high and 30% of the people say it's too high and don't show up, that has impact. So each community college is responsible for what I would call, you have to have a business plan. What's the pros and cons if you do that? And you might say, I'm going to raise the tuition to $75 per credit hour. And then ramifications of that decision might be, instead of gaining any money, you might gain more money, but you might lose 20% of your students. That's what the community colleges have, and I think community colleges argue it both ways. I want to be able to make my decisions, and I'd hate to see you change that, but perhaps I don't want to be accountable for those decisions. But that isn't a state board comment. That's an individual comment.
So that brings up a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, we said this
before
on Friday.
Dr. Berger, when you were president of Jamaica, were you ever in that position where you said, you know, I want to make decisions, but I don't want to be accountable for them?
I can't imagine you were.
I had to ask. Chair Buckley and Representative Cromwell, I always like to believe whatever I did made sense. So I tried to be accountable. I've been there for 27 years, and with that tenure, you're pretty accountable.
That is a long stretch.
I also, if you not know it, I did was the president of Portland Community College for a year when we had they raised the tuition from $47 to $60 per credit hour, and they wondered why they lost enrollment.
Right.
And I said, of course, I didn't have an. I mean, it's simple. The plan didn't quite work.
I thank all three of you for being here. Thank you for listening to my concerns. I think I'm concerned.
Thank you for inviting us.
Just one clarification. Perhaps the commissioner or the board could provide me with some information on the formula, and then I can distribute it among the members of the committee.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thank you.
Also, she's really good at briefing. That's just not anything to do, but I'm seriously, it's probably good to walk through it. It's a lot easier to understand.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Could we also ask legislative revenue for or is it fiscal? Anyway, the revenue runs on the community colleges, similar to what we get for the K-12 districts. I think that's something that would be very helpful. Also, so not only do we have the formula and understand how the formula is structured, but also have what the current plug-ins are.
That's a good suggestion. I'm sure Mr. Olson will make the request.
Mr. Chair, I'll follow up with legislative revenue, legislative fiscal, to see what they can provide us.
Members, thank you so much for your time and your patience. Hope you have a great weekend. We will meet in a full committee on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday next week. Currently, we are not scheduled for Thursday.
Correct. And we've issued the schedules, Mr. Chair, for all those, as well as the last day of April, Monday, April 30th.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. If there's nothing else, then I'll adjourn the hearing. See you next week. So next